Chapter 31, Let's Talk Turkey by Willie Snow Etheridge. 31, Where the Saints Have Trod. Antioch, which is only a 90-minute drive from Iskenderun, is a place where the first church to be called Christian was established soon after the death of Christ. The roommate told me this, and it shocked me considerably. I had never connected any of the events of the Bible with Turkey. I'm afraid I felt about Turkey just as Mr. Big, when he was 6 or 7, felt about Kentucky. Visiting a Baptist Sunday school in our old hometown of Macon, Georgia, he was asked some questions about the Ten Commandments and promptly answered, "We don't have the Ten Commandments in Kentucky." Similarly, I considered Turkey had no Ten Commandments or any other Christian history. As usual, I couldn't have been more mistaken, and as usual, doggone it, the roommate knew the facts all along. Having studied the Bible earnestly in his Methodist Baptist youth, he knew Antioch had played an important role in Apostle Paul's life. He was a bit vague about the details, and for days looked around the Moline Victory for a Bible. In the library on the Algonquin, there had been 7. None of them touched, so far as we could see. But here on the Moline, there was none. How could the American Bible Society have been so neglectful, the roommate grumbled. And then by accident, he found one in the first engineer's room. One Sunday morning, we read it, and was so delighted with himself that he wrote a letter to my good Baptist mother to tell her about it. And let me read the first few paragraphs to improve my mind. "Dear Sister Snow, I know you will be pleased that I spent all of yesterday reading the Bible. Willie and I were going to Old Antioch, and I wanted to see what the Bible said about it. If you will read the 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th chapters of the Acts, you will find a great deal about it. You remember that Paul, who was then Saul, was present at the stoning of Stephen in Jerusalem during the persecution of the Christians. Saul held the clothes of those who stoned Stephen to death. Shortly afterward, on the way to Damascus with special permission to arrest Christians there and bring them back to Jerusalem to be tried, he was blinded and converted and became the great apostle. When the pressure in Jerusalem got too great, many of the Nazarenes, as they were then called, fled to Antioch. The elders of the church, of whom Peter was the chairman, I believe, sent Barnabas to Antioch to shepherd the flock. He had great success in gaining converts, but apparently he felt that the job was too big for him and went over to Tarsus, Paul's hometown, which is in Turkey, not far from where we are, to get Paul. And according to the Acts, quote, when we had found him, he brought him into Antioch, and it came to pass that a whole year they assembled themselves with the church and taught much people. And the disciples called them Christians first in Antioch." Unquote. According to local tradition, the church was established in 43 AD, which would coincide pretty well with the persecution in Jerusalem, although local tradition also says the church was founded by St. Peter. That may be because Peter was head of the disciples and sent Barnabas to Antioch to take charge of the flock, out of which the church came, but I can't find any reference in the Bible to Peter's ever having been in Antioch. Paul must have been there sometime around 47 or 48 AD because he founded the churches in Greece, Salonica, Corinth, Berea, and Philippi in 51 AD. And he mentions in one of his epistles that he ministered for 3 years in Asia Minor, which included Antioch, Iconium, Ephesus, Sardis, and the province of Galatia, and other places mentioned in Acts and Revelations. Reading the roommate's last paragraph, I realized why I was so ignorant about Turkey's connection with the Bible. I never realized that Asia Minor of the Bible was now the eastern coastal lands of Turkey. Naturally, the roommate and I wanted to see Antioch, and happily, Saladin Bey and his wife, with children, would drive us there. Immediately after lunch, one hot day, we began to climb the high ridge of mountains that cup in Iskenderun. We had allowed 5 hours for the round trip and our sightseeing in Antioch. Saladin Bey said that would be a gracious plenty. At 6 o'clock, we must be back in Iskenderun to have a drink with Mr. Smith and some American neighbors he wanted us to meet. Near the top of the ridge, Saladin Bey stopped the car and everybody piled out to look at Iskenderun clinging to the half-moon rim of the sea far below. "It's beautiful, is it not?" exclaimed Saladin Bey, breathing deeply and flexing his muscles. "Frequently we drive up here just to admire the view. It is something very special." After a leisurely spell of admiring, we climbed back in the car and drove along twisting roads past tiny swatches of wheat fields. In one flat spot, a peasant and his wife were threshing wheat in that primitive fashion I had seen in Thrace, an ox dragging a heavy sled around in circles. "It's all right," Saladin Bey assured me heartily. "Fellers with small farms cannot afford threshing machines, and why should they?" We soon reached a mountain village famous for its excellent water and stopped, of course, to have a drink. It poured from a fountain next door to a meat market where two whole sheep and long coils of entrails hung above the sidewalk. Saladin Bey drank 3 or 4 glasses, proclaiming, "There is no drink like water. None. Absolutely none. All Turks are especially fond of water." On the other side of the fountain was a caravansary built about the middle of the 16th century by the order of Suleiman the Magnificent. Its graceful arches and vaulted domes, fashioned of small stones, amazed me. How could they make those little stones curve and climb inward one on top of another like that? I asked. What kept them from tumbling down like children's blocks as fast as they put them up? Saladin Bey rocked back on his heels. Suleiman had a gifted architect, Sinan. "Yes, I know." And with only a compass in his hand, he built this caravansary and many other beautiful things. No equipment, only brains. We wandered about in the courtyard, white with sun, surrounded on all four sides by these lovely arches that led in centuries past to rooms for travelers who came by camel or horse or across the Syrian desert or the plains of Anatolia or other distant parts. Though the curving roofs gaped with holes, the rooms were still being used unofficially. Donkeys, packs on their backs, nodded in some of them, and in one, two ragged men slept flat on the ground, chickens pecking about their faces and bare feet. When a donkey, being led away with his girlfriend or vice versa, bleated long and woefully, they did not stir a muscle. As I got back into the car, I complimented Saladin Bey on the good manners of his son, Mete. The boy had always waited by the door until everyone else was in the car. There's an old Turkish saying, "The outside warms the strangers, the inside burns me," answered Saladin Bey, which means, the child is so nice to strangers, but as soon as he gets home, he makes difficulties. "Not Mete," I answered, and Saladin Bey, like any father, beamed as bright as a street lamp. As we began to plunge down the mountain ridge, Saladin Bey prepared us for the view we were about to enjoy. It is a large lake set in a green valley that stretches as far as one can see. The lake once covered most of the valley, but it is filling up yearly with more and more silt. It is called Amik Lake. Amik is an Arab word meaning deep. They tell there is a city buried under the lake dating back to 5,000 or 6,000 B.C., Saladin Bey said. "Who knows? Fellers who come and go tell me." On a steep course, Saladin Bey slowed the car down. "Now you're about to see the lake that I told you about," he announced like a guide on a sightseeing bus, though he didn't have a megaphone. But then he didn't need a megaphone. He shouted everything so that the roommate who was sitting on the other side of me couldn't miss anything. The lake was bigger than I expected and not half so blue. The Mediterranean had spoiled me. Around it, the land rolled out flat from horizon to horizon without a noticeable village to break it. But when we descended into the valley, we passed some mud huts lying so flat upon the earth they were scarcely discernible. "Oh, there is one of those awful mud villages," I exclaimed involuntarily. "I like the ones I saw near Ankara." Sladen Bey shrugged his great shoulders. "This life is the survival of the fittest, but don't be troubled, my dear. They live very modestly. They have their small fields, their vegetables, their fruits. They are happy, and this is all the life they have seen." I took this with a grain of salt, but it was impossible to stay troubled. The road was exciting. Sycamores and oleander bushes lined it, but the sycamores are not straight as they are at home. They are permanently bent almost double from the wind that blows continuously from west to east, from the cool air of the seashore and mountains towards the Syrian desert. "Sorry next time, feller," Saladin Bey cried out as we passed the hitchhiker. Beyond the sycamores grew cotton, acres and acres of it. "The white gold has worked out properly," Saladin Bey explained, "and now everybody is planting it. But, oh, goodness, this is nothing. You should see the fields around Adana. There are thousands of acres, maybe millions." "Turkey seems to have everything," I said. "Yes, God has provided us with everything." His voice was a trumpet in more ways than one. "We have all kinds of crops, all kinds of fruits, all kinds of vegetables and animals. Oh, goodness, so many, many animals." And how right he was about the animals, that is. The edges of the road and the land lying fallow were massed with cows, water buffaloes, sheep, and goats. We slowed up frequently to let streams of them cross the road. "Yes, we have plenty of four-footed animals," Saladin Bey repeated. "If only we had some two-footed animals with sense, Turkey would be a great country." He sighed deeply, but the sight of the large agricultural experimental station cheered him immediately. "Our agricultural program is going beautifully. There are many experimental stations all over Turkey like these, and they are growing thousands of trees for the farms, acacias, cypresses, pines, fruits, everything. They are distributed free to all who want them. Take it easy there, feller." A shepherd was crossing the road behind his herd of goats. "And do you know something? These trees are changing the climate of Turkey. There used to be places in summer that were broiling. You can't find that anymore. They are hot, of course, but not broiling. The trees hold the moisture and make them cooler and fresher." "Turkey must be planting hundreds of them to change the climate," I suggested. He threw back his big head and whooped. "Thousands of them, my dear. Millions of them. We have one national holiday when every villager plants at least one tree." "Turkey is certainly making great strides," I said with some envy, I fear, in my voice. "Yes, I tell you, we've done a lot of things, but we lack a lot of things, too. We don't seem to know how to attract foreigners." "You mean tourists?" "No, I mean we don't know how to get along with the people of the United States who come here to help us. You say you can't unload ships because there are no barges. They cost practically nothing to build in Turkey. Why shouldn't there be enough? If you need 10 barges, give you 100 barges." And with much more fine talk, we arrived in Antioch, a clean-looking little city of about 25 or 30,000 people, flooded in white sunlight. "We will not stop here now," Saladin Bey said, "but while it is still hot, go on to the falls nearby." These were not like any falls I'd ever seen before, and I have seen Niagara Falls, the Yellowstone River Falls, Cumberland Falls in Kentucky, and Tallulah Falls in Georgia. In fact, I considered myself an old falls expert, but these were something new. They spring out of a mountainside in a dozen or more separate places like a herd of white wolves and scamper wildly here, there, everywhere, between fern-colored promontories to run still panting, but not quite so wildly, along tree-shaded ledges and even now and then to rest in wide, sun-splashed places. Saladin Bey was beside himself with excitement. "Everywhere you look, beautiful, clear, pure, delicious water," he caroled. It is not a sight worth traveling miles to see. From where does it come? Who knows? Who knows? He strode along the ledges, leaping from crag to crag. His family, the roommate, and I at his heels. Water rushed down us, encircling us. Saladin Bey loved it. So did the other Turks wandering here, a group of them, barefoot, sat on chairs around a table in the middle of a shallow stream, eating and drinking water, of course. How lovely, exclaimed Saladin Bey. If we only had the time, we could picnic in a stream, too. I stole a glance at the roommate. His blue eyes were practically popping out of his head with horror. An old man in tatters began to follow us about, and every so often he reached into his inside coat pocket and brought out an object to sell. These were very ancient things, he claimed. The fathers of Antioch recently bored a tunnel through the mountains, trying to locate the main source of the many falls so that a large portion of them could be channeled to the city, and in the turned-up earth, rare objects were found. One was an Alexander coin of the Phoenician period. The roommate wanted it, but Saladin Bey would not let him pay the asking price. Leave it to me, he said authoritatively, and I will get it for you at half the price. And after spirited bargaining, he did. We scrambled up a dozen boulders, and the old man reached into his shirt and pulled a small statue of the Virgin Child. Very, very old, my lady, he declared. Alabaster and very, very rare. Nothing like it has been unearthed before. It was nice in a primitive way, I felt. Maybe it belonged to those early Christians of Paul's time. It would be a fine present for my good friend, Edie Callahan. How much, I asked. 10 liras, the old man answered. My heart leaped. 10 liras is roughly $3.35. How very reasonable for a rare old piece. 1 lira, said Saladin Bey, and the bargaining was on. But the old man was stubborn. This statue was a precious, priceless thing. Saladin Bey strolled on indifferently, motioning to the roommate and me to follow him. I was undone. Suppose the old man didn't follow us, but he did, and finally a compromise was reached halfway between the asking and offering prices. I felt guilty and unhappy at getting it for so little. It was a steal, yet if I didn't take it, some other tourist would. I fondled it lovingly. How many, many hands must have caressed it before mine? We scrambled up another dozen boulders and stopped to let Matei wade in a quiet pool and to admire a fresh view of the frisking tails of water. And there beside us was the old man again, in his hand another rare alabaster virgin, exactly lined. More climbing, sliding, jumping, meandering. Time meant nothing to Saladin Bey in this enchanted land of falling water. Rocks, ferns, pools, and sunlight. He brought a handful of shelled, whole English walnuts, kept by the salesman in a large apothecary jar of water, and passed them out amongst us. You must peel the skin from them, he explained, or they will be bitter. So scratching with a damp brownish skin that sticks tighter than scotch tape, we continued to wander about until the roommate reminded Saladin Bey as tactfully as possible that we had come on this trip to see Antioch. Certainly, Saladin Bey agreed, but Antioch will not be so pleasant a sight as is running water. Oh, goodness me, how generous God has been to Turkey. I could spend the afternoon happily here. I, too, answered the roommate, still being tactful, but unfortunately we do not have the afternoon to spend. You remember, we must be back in Iskenderun by 6. You're exactly right, Mr. Mark. We must go immediately to Antioch. Nevertheless, at the entrance to the falls, where a nice-looking resort hotel clung to a ledge above the ravine, Saladin Bey had another idea. How about a cup of Turkish coffee and a cool, clear glass of spring water, he asked. No, thank you, the roommate said firmly. If we're going to see Antioch, I think we should start. You are exactly right, Mr. Mark. Into the car, everybody, into the car. We sped toward Antioch through orchards of papaya, orange, and lemon trees. But in the first shopping street, we stopped again. Bins of fruit had caught Saladin Bey's eyes. If you will excuse me for a few minutes, I think I will buy some apples and pears to take home. He opened the trunk of the car and took out a deep brown basket and went back down the street towards the bins of fruit. The roommate got out and stood by the door of the car. I was nervous about him. An old cook once described him as a short-patiented man, and I feared he was reaching the end of his patience. I prayed Saladin Bey would be quick about his purchases. He was fairly quick, but only the pears suited him. He tilted the basket carefully for his wife and children to see before storing it in the trunk. Now we will visit the office of the local agent of the Sokoni Vakum, he announced heartily, and we will see the red flying horse that is the sign. No, sign is not the right word. It is too cold and big. Symbol is better, the symbol of friendly service. After an amazingly brief stop at the agent's, we visited a large and exceedingly handsome museum containing monuments and mosaics of five or six civilizations, including that of the Hittites. The mosaics were especially fine, and Saladin Bey was carried away by them. I think they are the best mosaics that can be found, he cried. Who can imitate them? But the roommate was not impressed. Mosaics, he muttered to me darkly, appealed to me less than anything in the whole wide world, and he looked again and again at his watch. Finally, Saladin Bey took the hint. You think it is getting late, do you, Mr. Mark? My goodness, what a shame, what a shame. We could spend the afternoon happily here. If we had not already spent it at the falls, a roommate muttered, but thank heavens, softly. Turkey is a most interesting country, Saladin Bey continued joyously. So many civilizations have passed this way, but as you say, Mr. Mark, it is getting late. Not getting, said the roommate, forcing a smile. It is late, and Mr. Smith is expecting us at 6. Ah, poor Mr. Smith, and he is such a very pleasant man, too. The roommate's irritation faded temporarily. Saladin Bey's spirits are infectious, but he did say, it is now 4:30, and it takes at least 1 hour and 15 minutes, doesn't it, to drive to Iskenderun, and we have not yet seen the church. We will go now directly to the church, Saladin Bey promised, but he forgot he hadn't yet visited the new filling station of the Sokoni Vakum with the sign, symbol of friendly service, in the outskirts of Antioch. There we were greeted warmly by the agent and an exceedingly handsome blond man who I was sure was Norwegian until Saladin Bey said he was Turkish. Someday, perhaps, I would become accustomed to blond Turks. It is a pleasant thought, I must say, but up to now they never failed to startle me. Our agent at the friendly service offers us a gazozu, Saladin Bey announced. If we refuse, it will break his heart. So we had gazosu, inspected the inside and outside of the filling station, complimented the agent on the neatness and cleanliness of everything, shook hands with everybody who came up, and at last continued on our way. And this time we actually reached the church. Because of the persecution of those days, it was built in a rock 100 feet or so up the side of a mountain. It must have taken that small band of Christians many, many months of back-breaking work. They tunneled a low entrance into the mountain and then, inside, hollowed the rock to a high, impressive height and comfortable circumference. At one side is a spring where I suppose they baptize people. On the other side, an entrance that leads to a tunnel stairway into the mountain. There, in times of peril, the congregation hid. Little narrow slits cut into the face of the rock gave them air and, according to Saladin Bey, advantageous points from which to shoot their bows and arrows at the enemy. I couldn't imagine, though, those persecuted Christians shooting arrows and thus revealing their hiding place, and I said as much to Saladin Bey. Like a gentleman, he didn't argue with me, only shook his lion-sized head and mourned, tish, 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 to think of those poor Christians to be treated like dogs. Emerging from the damp, cool hole into the eye-squinting sun, I saw in the distance the many cypress-slim minarets of the Mosque of Antioch and wondered for a moment how the teachings of Muhammad displaced the teaching of Christ here in the very cradle of Paul's missionary work. Muhammad must have had a Paul too. I didn't question the roommate, who of course knows everything, for he was rearing now to head for Mr. Smith's and that drink. He had had a sufficiency of cool, clear spring water and gazozu for one day. We would be at least an hour and a half late, but perhaps if we rushed like mad, there would still be a few cubes of ice and something to pour over them. But stars, if Saladin Bey didn't decide to return to Iskenderun by way of Syria. Really, there are two roads through the vast valley around Lake Amik, one running within a few yards of the Syrian border, and this is the one he chose, saying nonchalantly, "It's longer, but much more interesting." "How about Mr. Smith?" asked the roommate, sounding very painful. "Poor Mr. Smith, and such a nice fellow. I'm truly sorry, but we must be a little late." The border, where we drove along it, is at the edge of a rich green valley at the front of a range of bare rocky hills. The valley, of course, is Turkish. The hills, Syria. It's Turkey. The hills, Syria. Ataturk did a clever day's work when he persuaded France, which held a mandate over Syria, at that time including Antioch and the Amik Valley and even Iskenderun, to take it from Syria and give it to Turkey. We saw a little Syrian village built entirely of very white stones and clinging to the instep of one of those barefaced hills, and in spite of my delightful Turkish host, my heart ached for it. Soldiers lolled near a whitewashed border post, and machine guns stood on man-made mounds near the side of the road. Turkey had recently increased her border patrol to try to put a stop to smuggling. Because of low taxes or no taxes at all, Syrian goods were much cheaper than Turkey's, and smuggling has become a grave problem. The main things smuggled are clothes, embroideries, and jewelry. The black flat land flowed on and on. Clusters of bamboo and mud huts were scattered sparsely upon it. They were temporary affairs, Saladin Bey assured me. "The villagers camp here during summer to be near their lovely black land," he said, "but they must work because of the heat, mostly at night. If you look from the mountains at night and see all the lights of the tractors on the land, you think the sky and stars have come down." In this section alone, there are 120 tractors. One of the 120 tractors lumbered by us, and Saladin Bey called to the driver in English to use a certain grade of Saucony vacuum oil. "It's the only thing for tractors, feller." A little later, Saladin Bey burst into song. The beautiful land, the sun beginning to draw itself into a ball to slip beneath the rocky hills on the western horizon, the smooth highway spinning out between the bending trees were too much for him. "Oh, Susanna, don't you cry for me," he sang with no tune to mention, but much gusto. Gosh, such gusto. "I come from Alabama with a banjo on my knee." Old Black Joe followed, and then "Love's Old Sweet Song" and "Flow Gently, Sweet Afton." These are among the roommate's favorite songs, and after the first shock of finding a Turk who had never been to the United States or England familiar with the songs we know, we tried to sing with him, but he drowned us all out on every note. We had been sailing along without a stop for some little time and were beginning to have hope of reaching Mr. Smith's after all, when suddenly Saladin Bey spied watermelons in a village square and slammed on the brakes. "I think I'll buy a few of these melons," he announced, but as he started to get out of the car, his wife spoke to him in Turkish and he released the brake and drove on. "What did she say to you?" I was forced by curiosity to ask. He smiled ruefully. "She says there are watermelons in Iskenderun." But his wife couldn't stop him the next time he put on the brakes. We were in another village with exceptional water. "The water is so nice, everybody is happy about it," he exclaimed. "No kidney trouble, no liver trouble, no stomach trouble, no nothing trouble." He opened the car door and prepared to descend. "Ah, we will have some of the water now. My poor mouth is feeling cotton." All of us, except Saladin's Saladin Bey's wife, trotted across the street to a fountain. But we had to wait in line for several women in brightly colored print dresses so long that only a few inches of their full ankle-length pantalons showed and were ahead of us with their earthen jars. Saladin Bey waited, unconcerned, but the roommate moved about restlessly with a "What will Mr. Smith say?" look on his face. When my turn came, I drank cup upon cup. After all, I was sure my kidneys, liver, and stomach could use it. Back in the car, the roommate discovered Matei was missing. "Where is the boy?" he asked in alarm. "Oh, my goodness, he has gone on an errand to find some of that bread they bake here and that we like so," Saladin Bey answered. With my inward ear, I could hear the roommate groan. We cruised slowly along the main street, hoping to see him. When we did, he was carrying unwrapped one of those large, round, flat loaves of bread, something like an overgrown batter cake. As we drove on toward Iskenderun, Saladin Bey's wife tore off small pieces of it and doled it out to us. It was tough and with little taste, but I was hungry and thankful for it. We reached the top of the mountain ridge circling Iskenderun just at the hour of taps as the sun was lowering its streaming colors. "Och, och, the colors, the beauty," cried you-know-who. How can you explain the redness? Then down swiftly into Iskenderun and straightway to Mr. Smith's. Would he ever forgive us? Would he? Certainly, he insisted. Did he understand? Quite. We should not give it another thought. But alas, his understanding and forgiveness were of little comfort. The ice had melted long before, and drinking was definitely finished. End of chapter 31.